Good morning, everyone. I'm John Garamendi, Lieutenant Governor. Joining me today is John Chung, our Controller, and Tom Sheehy, the Chief Deputy Director of the Department of Finance, and I'm calling this meeting of the State Lands Commission to order. For the benefit of those in the audience, the State Lands Commission administers property interests owned by the people of the state of California, including its mineral interest. Today, we will hear proposals concerning the leasing and management of these publicly owned properties and their interests therein. The first item of business is the adoption of the minutes from the Commission's last meeting. Would one of my colleagues like to make a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
Without objection, so approved. The next order of business is the Executive Officer's report. Mr. Thayer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission. I'd like to first start off by introducing the representatives from the Attorney General's office who are here with us this morning. There are different faces than Joe Rusconi or Alan Hager. And on the far right, or my far right, is Dan Siegel. And to his left is Mike Crow. Both of them have extensive experience in dealing with public trust matters. They're here because Joe couldn't make it this morning, but we're in good hands.
Oh, we'll cancel the meeting.
Yeah, there you go. I then wanted to move on, as is our custom during the EO report, and talk a little bit about progress on resolving some of the violations. With respect to Jeannie Taylor, who owned the house, the floating house in the Delta, as we previously mentioned, she has sold that house. And the one remaining thing that she needs to do is to shorten the size of her dock, which is over 100 feet long, and she is expected to begin the application process with the Corps of Engineers, where she needs to start, and the Central Valley Flood Protection Board, formerly the REC Board, and we expect that. We've written her a letter as recently as October 8th outlining this process to her. The floating home that she used to own, as the Lieutenant Governor knows, it's not far from his house. It's still a problem. We've continued to try and contact the person who now owns it. We're not sure if he's living on it or not. Our view is if we're not able to resolve this by our next regular meeting, that we're likely to bring a request for enforcement authorization to the Commission in December.
If you'd like, I could stop by tomorrow morning and drop off the enforcement notice.
Yeah, perfect.
I drove by it today, and it's still where it shouldn't be.
There you go. Well, we'll call on you. We won't be shy.
Yeah, let me know. I'll just drop it off one morning.
And then the next one is the Cortland Docks. This is a very small marina owned by Sean Berrigan and Diane House. There were a variety of different issues. The docks were in poor shape, and the house extended out over public trust lands. Both those issues have been resolved. The only thing left is to have them post the appropriate bond. As it turns out, the two of them are both now filed for bankruptcy. So we're not sure how this is going to turn out, but we're pursuing it. This is the sort of thing we just need to keep dogging. And as we reported at the last meeting, in her papers for bankruptcy, Diane House claimed that the boat there was her personal residence. And as the Commission knows, residential use of public trust lands is prohibited. And her response when we raised this issue with her is that she was merely trying to come up with some mechanism to save her boat from being seized in bankruptcy. We told her she couldn't have it both ways, and we've notified the trustees in the bankruptcy proceeding that this can't be considered a personal residence. With respect to John Asuncion, we're still working on the final complaint on that. We wanted to make sure we'd gotten it right. Our surveyors have been out there before, but we've sent them out again. However, the improvements that he has on state property there are also a violation of BCDC requirements. There's no permit for them. And on October 29th, BCDC will consider an enforcement action of their own against him. So we're continuing to work on that. And then finally, as I think I told the commissioners individually, one of our counsels, Jennifer Lucchesi, and I were down in Long Beach a week and a half ago and managed to serve process for the Spirit of Sacramento. That's the ferry that's about 2 miles downstream from downtown Sacramento and is half sunk. I don't want to cast aspersions, but the AG's office had hired two different process servers who couldn't find this person, and so we went to Long Beach on this other matter and went down to his tour boat there, and he was sitting there, and he was served. So at least that process will now move forward.
It's kind of like a little red hen, I'll do it myself.
Right, exactly. I think Jennifer's going to open up a side business and be paid more than the state can.
Did you get processing fees?
Right, exactly.
Bill the Attorney
did
General.
We should consider that. That's probably duties as assigned.
Bill the Attorney General and get the processing fees to help your budget.
Save them from having to hire a third one. And the final one that I wanted to point out was the Hulbert situation. This is the overbuilt dock. It was the boathouse that was built much larger than the commission had authorized. We're proceeding on that in a legalistic sense. There's been depositions on both sides. The Hulbert side has now asked for production of a variety of documents, and we have to respond next week. So I'm sure there'll be a lot more steps to go, but this is moving along at a good pace in terms of dealing with the litigation there.
This is the one here in Sacramento?
It's just south. And again, he had overbuilt and put the kitchenette on top and the bathroom in there and that kind of thing. I think the structure was 8 feet higher than we had authorized. So that concludes, unless there are any questions, update on the violations.
I do have a question. I don't think it was a violation. We were pursuing this issue at Tahoe of another boat, the dock and boathouse.
We'd had one earlier this year, and that was all successfully resolved at the last meeting, that they took down the second-story deck, and you'll recall they had that thing out there without a lease for decades, and they came in and they applied for the lease. They removed the railing that made and steps that made it into a deck, and the commission approved a lease for that. So that's been a success story. The next matter that I wanted to discuss is that the lieutenant governor earlier this week or last week asked for an update on our attempts to get more auditors to look at whether or not the state's getting all the revenues it deserves from the leases that we have. Commission had been directed, several years ago we received approval for a limited term additional auditor. Our auditors originally numbered 7 and we're down to 3 now because of various cutbacks. Back in, I think, 2007, we were authorized to hire a temporary auditor for 2 years, and the legislature, as part of that authorization, required the commission to produce a report on how efficient these auditors were, what the gains were to the state in additional revenues from the auditing. The report was issued in 2008, and I think you have copies up there, and there are copies out on the table if people in the audience want to see it. And basically, the report concluded that the auditors returned over $1 million apiece in additional revenues, and that this additional auditor specifically could be credited with over $1 million for having that additional auditor. It was new money that wouldn't have been produced if we only had 3 auditors. The lieutenant governor asked that we update this, and so we've done that. And so we have a staff presentation on that, which talks about going back and looking at what's happened since that report has come out. And Dave Brown will give the report on that.
Tom, heads up.
I'm hanging on every word, Lieutenant Governor.
Mineral Audit Land Program. As Paul said, we presented to you on December 3rd, 2007, commission meeting a report that was later submitted to the legislature. This update will include the current condition of the audit program, the contributions that the audit staff continues to make, and the continuing need for additional auditors so we can audit leases that have not received adequate examination in the past and add potential and additional recoveries to the state. Since 1997, the audit staff has been reduced from 7 auditors and 1 support staff to 3 auditors and no support staff. As a result, the projected audit frequency of the largest oil and gas leases is now about every 7 to 9 years. Such a frequency makes audits very difficult due to the availability of records and knowledgeable staff. Statute of limitation questions could also jeopardize some of those claims. A reasonable frequency would be 3 to 5 years. However, that would require at least two more auditors and preferably three. As oil prices continue to climb and at the risk of loss of state revenues will continue to rise also. As mentioned earlier, the Commission received and approved a report on the audit program to the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. That report demonstrated the value of a two-year limited-term position added in July 2006. The findings in their report included that the value of that additional auditor was approximately $1.6 million per year. The additional auditor did not diminish the recoveries on a per-auditor basis. The audit findings not only resulted in immediate recoveries, but also enhanced the revenue flow in the future by correcting reporting errors. A timely audit program has a positive effect on the conduct of other unaudited lessees as well. And as we saw in the Hanson Sand recovery, it demonstrated the value of pursuing some of these unaudited leases. The report further recommended that an additional three auditors be added to meet these statutory limitations. The current audit program conditions reveal that 50% of the audit time is on the Long Beach unit and Long Beach Tidelands. And while this covers about 70% of the Commission's total revenues, it leaves little time to audit other significant revenue-producing leases. Larger leases such as ERA and DECOR in Huntington Beach, Oxy in Seal Beach, and Benico in Santa Barbara have audit frequency of 7 to 9 years. In the prior fiscal year alone, these leases accounted for over $36 million in state revenues. There is no time available to audit geothermal or mineral or dredging leases. And as we saw with Hanson Sand, even these smaller leases can add up to significant losses if left unaudited. In the case of surface leases such as commercial marinas, only the absolute worst offenders are pursued due to time constraints. Even with the lower staffing levels, next slide please. Even with these lower staffing levels, Commission auditors continue to achieve significant recoveries. Last year we averaged $1.4 million per audit, per auditor, or a 10-to-1 return on investment. You have also been provided with a history of recoveries in the handout that was provided you over the past six fiscal years. We believe we have demonstrated the value of additional auditors. To meet a reasonable level of auditing that would result in a 3 to 5 year audit frequency, an additional three auditors would be required. The potential losses will only increase as oil prices rise. In conclusion, we continue to emphasize and strongly believe that a higher level of staffing will provide increased benefits to the state, and those benefits will greatly outweigh the costs involved.
Thank you very much for your report. This has been a long time concern of this commission. We recognize the difficult problems that the state has. However, I would ask my fellow commissioners to make a motion and then to approve a letter to be sent to the governor and the Department of Finance and the appropriate legislative committees asking for an immediate authorization to hire temporary auditors so that we can increase the revenue to the state of California. It's rather obvious from this report that there are substantial revenues that can be achieved to help mitigate the current crisis that the state has, the fiscal crisis. How many would you recommend we ask for?
To begin with, at least two.
At least two.
Mm-hmm.
What is the optimal number?
Optimal, based on the schedule we provided, three plus a support position.
And what is the approximate cost, annual approximate cost, for those three plus one or two?
About $460,000.
And the potential return?
Based on our per audit, maybe 4.5 to 5 million.
So it's 10 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's the will of the commission, I would like our executive officer to prepare a letter coupled with the report and a request for three auditors, These would be temporary positions. I assume that going for a permanent position would be. Perhaps we should ask for permanent positions and settle for temporary.
Well, they'll be established temporary for the first year.
All right.
By procedure.
Well, then let's recommend perhaps two paragraphs, one, a temporary one for the remainder of this year, and then ask for the permanent positions beginning in the next budget year.
Very well.
Paul, could you comment on my suggestion, and then the commission can take this issue up?
We'd be glad to do that. I think because this is a non-noticed item, we probably can't really go through the formal technicalities of a motion. If you wanted to do that, we'd have to bring it back. But certainly if it's the sense of the commission that if the commission is asking me to do that as executive officer, I'm happy to do that, and it would be done in that guise.
Well, perhaps to expedite this and to not create uncomfortable positions amongst my members, I could ask you to do that as chair of the commission.
Certainly.
Okay.
And if there were no objections from the commissioners, I would just go ahead and do that.
Mr. Chairman, may I comment?
Please.
I have, in my role as a state lands commissioner, I have no objection at all. And in my role as taking that out for a minute, as my role as Chief Deputy Director, Department of Finance, we always welcome communication from state agencies and from government officials, elected officials, on suggestions on how the state can execute its programs more efficiently and more effectively. So we'd be happy to receive that letter. I would just note that I think what your staff, Mr. Thayer, already knows, which we have a timeline for our budget process. This particular request coming at this point won't dovetail in real nicely with that, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't be considered in the context of a spring letter in the May revise. After all, even if it was included in the governor's budget in January, it wouldn't take effect until next summer. So I would urge you to consider that. And I would only add that I'm delighted to see that the commission is still interested in getting more revenues out of oil. And if they'd like to discuss that further, I have some great ideas on how we can do that.
I understand.
I'm strongly supportive. The state's continuing to experience significant deterioration in our revenues, and we're going to have a prolonged bumpy bottom in California. So to not revisit the extended discussions about further cuts and increased taxes, I think the state needs to be far more efficient in identifying existing resources, and so I think this is the appropriate path to take.
Well, I'll make sure to get that letter together and get it off in the next week. The only other small points that I wanted to make during the executive officer's report is to publicly acknowledge the request from LADWP to remove the Moton Road project from consideration of the commission at this meeting. That we received a fax letter on, I believe, on Tuesday from David Freeman, the acting manager, requesting this, and we generally accede to those requests. Ultimately, of course, any project applicant can withdraw an application if we don't want to accede to that request, so it always makes sense to go ahead and do that and give them the additional time they've asked for. The letter asks that the matter be reset for the next commission meeting. And in that regard, I wanted to report what I think you already know, and certainly your staffs do, that we're scheduled to have two meetings one meeting each in November and December. The first one, November 16th, in Sacramento, will focus exclusively on the PG&E Pipeline 406-407. It's a gas pipeline just north of Sacramento, and it's a special meeting. The next regularly scheduled meeting will be December 17th in San Diego, and I would propose to put the Moton Row project on for that meeting for commission consideration if that works out for LA.
Paul, excuse me. Tom and I were having a conversation on the previous item, the audit. The commission has the power and the authority to contract for services, do we not?
Yes, sir.
Is it limited in a way that would preclude us from contracting with someone to audit these oil companies?
I would want to get back to you on that, because there's some union and labor contract issues here that we'd want to make sure we had that ability.
Okay. Let me make a suggestion.
Sure.
And Tom and I would talking about this just a moment ago. I'd like you to pursue the notion of a contract with either individuals or a company to audit the books of the oil and other of our lessees, that the recoveries would be used to pay for their services. I think we want to be a little careful here about how to draft such a contract. It may be, this is not uncommon, at least at the federal government level, but if you would look at that and see if we can, the problem here is one of going through the rigor of the hiring and permission from the normal state procedures. But if we have some way for the commission itself to contract with an auditor and to pay for that service, either as a, for example, a percentage of the recoveries or some other mechanism, it may be that we would expedite this.
Mr. Chairman, may I comment?
Yes, Tom.
I agree with everything the chairman just said, and I just would point out that this wouldn't the concept is not precedent-setting. There are private sector companies out there that specialize in government efficiency. That's not an oxymoron. And the way they get compensated is through taking a percentage of the savings. And so they basically offer their services as a no-cost, you know, no downside, only upside. Now, I've never heard of those firms working as auditors on state mineral and oil leases. So in that sense, it may be precedent setting, but the general concept in terms of that type of contract and how they get compensated has been done in many states, including California and including state government. So I think it is certainly worth looking into. It may take some footwork and legwork and thinking a little bit outside the box, but that might be a way to get at this without having to go through what is clearly going to be a very difficult legislative budget process considering the state of our finances.
Paul, I want to pick up on your point about the union and state employees and the like. I would see this as a temporary process, and then the next, either in, I guess it's going to have to be in the a budget change proposal for next year, that we then bring these people, we would then move to have permanent staff on board. If you could pursue that and look at the options and the opportunities.
Sure.
Together with, you know, short-term, immediate, and then a longer-term program.
And I will do that, and I will get back to the commissioner's offices either through email or at the next commission meeting.
As appropriate. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, that essentially concludes the report. As I say, the next two commission meetings are to deal with the PG&E pipeline, November 16th in Sacramento, and then a general commission meeting December 17th in San Diego. And that concludes the executive officer's report.
Thank you very much, Paul. The next order of business is the consent calendar. Paul, if you would give us the items that are to be included in this, and then the commissioners, if there's anyone that any of the commissioners that like to remove a consent item, it would be appropriate following your comments, and if there's anybody in the audience that would like to comment on any of this.
The calendar item 22, we'd like to remove from the consent calendar and to have it heard at a succeeding commission meeting. And then calendar item 27, we've received an opposition letter. We don't think that the person who wrote that is here today, but by our rules of only putting matters on consent where there's no opposition, we feel it appropriate to remove that. And what we propose to do is just, we think the presentation can be brief. We'd also like to make a staff amendment to the recommendation as part of that presentation. We can get that out of the way right after the consent calendar is adopted.
Very good. And there is an individual in the audience that would like to comment on that also. If it was removed, and it has been removed. So item 22 and 27 are removed?
Yes.
Any other, and the issues, the consent calendar is before the commission. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
We have a motion. Any objections? No objections. Unanimous consent. Unanimous vote on the consent calendar. Paul, great. If you'd like to take up item 27.
Thank you. Item 27 involves a lease for a seawall or an improvement to a seawall in Solana Beach. And Barbara DeGaulle, who's chief of the Land Management Division, will give the staff presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Barbara DeGaulle, and I am the chief of the Land Management Division. And calendar item 27 involves staff's recommendation for the issuance of a general lease protective structure use. It's for the construction repair of a seawall down in Solana Beach in San Diego County. The commission first approved a lease in this for this seawall back in 1994. At the same time, the commission also approved a compromise title settlement agreement with the then Upland property owner. However, that agreement was never executed by the parties. What we have before you today is, again, the issuance of a new lease, a 10-year lease for the seawall. And Surf Riders has submitted objections to the issuance of a lease based on two accounts. One is that they don't believe that there's a public benefit that's been derived here. And staff has looked at this, and based on our review, we believe that there is a minor public benefit that the public will be receiving, in that it'll provide some stabilization of the bluff face, but we also realize that there is a major private benefit to the Upland property owner. Another item in the Surf Riders email asking for denial of the lease is that they don't believe that the revenue should go to the state, that the revenue should be used to offset mitigation, and the Coastal Commission has secured funds for sand replenishment in the amount of $15,000. And so staff would recommend that you approve the lease as before you today with the augmentation that Paul mentioned earlier. And that is that in the event that upon staff's review and review of the as-built for the seawall, and upon staff's concurrence that if any portion of the seawall as it's constructed is not located on state lands, then the rent would be proportionally reduced based on that percentage. However, if it's found based on a review of those as-built drawings that any of the seawall is not covered under the lease, then the applicant would have to come in for an amendment to that lease to get that additional area under lease. So, if there's any questions?
I think Mr. Winkler is here, would like to comment.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is David Winkler. I'm the owner of the property that's requesting the land lease. I had submitted to you a document that addresses the benefits of seawalls, and hopefully you've got that along with a card attached to it that looks something like this, that talks about the city of Solana Beach urging people to go nowhere near these bluffs. Five people have been killed since 1995 in the North San Diego County area. So we think there's a real safety issue, and that seawalls help to eliminate that. There have been no deaths where seawalls have been built. The city of Solana Beach itself holds its junior lifeguard program in front of a seawall, not where there are no seawalls. So there's a real problem with the lack of safety and then the increase in safety at tremendous cost to homeowners who will spend upwards of $500,000 for 50 feet of seawall, which not only, granted, protects the property, but also ultimately protects city infrastructure and all the utilities, roads, sidewalks, et cetera. So we're saving the city that cost. The city's own analyst said that the city's getting a free ride on the homeowners' backs. And I think in the past, the city also has recognized increased revenues due to higher property taxes, as well as increased tourism, et cetera. So considering that, and that the homeowners are really not responsible for the lack of upland sand supply, we think there are a whole lot of public benefits, and I'm sort of glossing over this memo that I gave to you, but hopefully you'll introduce it in the record and consider all of the benefits, because I think they're substantial. I would rather not build a seawall, but my house is in jeopardy, and the city of Solana Beach unanimously voted in favor of this, as did the Coastal Commission. With respect to staff's recommendation, I completely support it. The only thing I would modify is whether the land area goes up or down in order to save you the time of having to hear this again, is to just adjust the land lease rate on a pro rata basis. So if it's more square footage, which I don't think it will be, because I've made a real effort to pull the seawall back onto my property, and it appears that we've been able to eliminate 60%, which I'm sorry, 60 square feet, which is a significant percentage of the area to be occupied. It's minimal, and again, it's in a very hazardous area. So happy to answer any questions if I can. Yes.
Tom, quick question. Thank you for coming to Sacramento today, Mr. Winkler. I don't understand this wave of opposition from the surf riders. What is it they don't like about the seawall? How does it affect their surfing?
Well, to quote one of them, I don't like sitting on my surfboard and looking at seawalls.
So this is a visual issue for them? I mean, this doesn't impede their ability to ride the waves in any way?
Not at all. And frankly, a lot of money is spent to color and contour the walls so that they blend in quite well. And you would potentially be hard-pressed in some instances to tell the difference between the natural bluff and the seawall.
Thank you.
Paul?
There are other issues that are raised when this goes to the Coastal Commission and elsewhere, and one of them is, in general, this project obviously does not extend very far out onto the beach at all. It has a very small impact on public trust lands, but that's not always the case with some of the seawalls, and I think the surf riders believe that if public trust land, which is used by surfers and other members of the public recreating, is used to protect private property, then there's a loss. And so they question very closely projects like this because of that impact to the public. The other element,
Mr. Thayer, wouldn't the pushback on that be if there's a collapse of one of these bluffs and there's members of the public nearby, they're going to get killed?
Certainly.
So to the extent that this helps prevent that, that adds to the public trust value of the state tidelands.
Right, and certainly staff agrees with that to the extent that we're recommending a lease rate which is reduced by a third because of that public benefit. So I'm not trying to represent what I'm saying as just being the staff's position, but when you ask what the issues were that were raised more generally, there's the impact generally from seawalls on the public use of the beaches. And the other one, which Mr. Winkler actually raises in his letter, is there's at least some contribution to the beach. He alleges that it's 5%, some studies say more, some say less, from the sand that would come from these bluffs. So in a natural condition, if you didn't put a seawall in there, they occasionally collapse. Sometimes they get people. But the point is you're interfering with a natural process and reducing the size of the beach by preventing that from happening. Now, there's good public policy reasons for doing that in terms of saving lives, and there's also, of course, a private benefit because people's houses are saved by doing that, but it has an impact on the amount of sand that's on the beach. So those are the two issues that I've heard. Probably Mr. Winkler has heard a lot of, too.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'd like to just respond quickly. All people that build seawalls have to pay a sand mitigation fee that replenishes the amount of sand that is held back. Most oceanographers estimate that the bluffs supply 2 to 5% of the sand needed for a healthy beach. So with current erosion, as well as deprivation of upland sources and global warming, which may cause sea level rise, most predict that without substantial replenishment and retention of sand, that there will be no beach. It's unfortunate, but at least we're contributing to a fund that will result in significant sand replenishment projects. So I don't think there's any loss of use. And actually, one of these deaths happened 30 feet out from the face of the bluff. And when you consider the relatively small footprint of a seawall, you're actually causing a significant net increase in the amount of usable beach. So I would argue it's the complete opposite. And in fact, my memo encourages not to charge any rent. But that said, I'm happy to pay the amount that staff's recommending, subject to that pro rata adjustment for the actual footprint.
And in response to Mr. Winkler's suggestion, yes, I think this makes sense. Why don't we just say that the staff's recommendation would be that if further surveys, especially in the as-built condition, which is the actual occupation of our land, show a decrease down to zero or an increase of up to twice the size, that we'll accommodate that through a pro rata change in the rent. I'd say if the increase were more than 100%, then maybe we'd want to bring it back. Staff would normally say this should come back to the commission. It's up to you to decide these things. But because we're only starting with a base of 120 square feet, we're talking about a fairly small amount, and I think it'd be better to handle it administratively.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, may I make a motion? Is it appropriate time for a motion?
Yeah, let me just ask the question. The Coastal Commission has approved this project?
Yes, sir, it has, and imposed the sand mitigation fee that Mr. Winkler references.
Okay, then we have a modification to the original proposal for the lease. Paul, could you just quickly review the modifications?
Certainly.
And then we'll take the motion.
Original lease contemplates renting 120 square feet of public trust lands for the seawall at a cost of $900 a year. The amendment would say that this would the amount of the rent would be reduced on a pro rata basis based on a final survey agreed to by staff, which shows an increase or decrease of the amount of square feet that are occupied by the seawall, with a sideboard that if that increase is more than an additional 120 square feet, that it would be brought back to the commission.
Tom, you have a motion?
I would move approval of the staff recommendation on item number 27 as amended by Mr. Thayer.
Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Without objection, it'll be unanimous. So done.
Thank you.
Moving along here, Paul.
This brings us to the regular calendar, and the first item up is item 59. This is a report by our legislative liaison, Mario DiBernardo, who will talk about the results of this last legislative session and recommend that the commission sponsor three new pieces of legislation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Commissioners, my name is Mario DiBernardo. As Mr. Thayer stated, I have a three-slide presentation, and I'll try to keep this quick. So as stated, the first part of my presentation will give a quick status update on some of the bills that staff has followed this year, and then I will present legislative proposals for the upcoming legislative year. As you can see, the first four items, as indicated by the third column, are four bills that the commission voted to sponsor last January. The first bill, AB 248, is regarding ballast water. It allows the commission to collect information on treatment systems on vessels just in time for the first implementation date of our ballast water discharge schedule that begins January 1st. And that bill was signed by the governor recently, and it also gives the commission the authority to, through the rulemaking process, request additional information from vessel operators so that we don't have to go through the legislative process again when we need additional information. The Pacific Merchant Shipping Association was helpful in supporting this bill and sending a letter to the governor. Unfortunately, the next two bills were vetoed. SB 459 was regarding abandoned vessels. It was going to give the commission the authority to administratively address the problem with abandoned vessels, trespassing vessels, and trespassing buoys. It was vetoed. I could go into the speculation as to why it was vetoed. The veto message cites hidden implementation costs. We think that there is a way to fund this sort of administrative action through ship salvers. TRPA is a potential source, federal funding. So we may pursue this in the future, but there's no plans immediately. AB 368 was a bill that would have required lessees to quitclaim their oil and gas or mineral leases after reclamation was completed and approved by the commission. Currently, the statute states that a lessee can quit claim their lease at any time, and currently we have two situations where lessees have quit claimed their leases before reclamation, and as the reclamation period progresses, we're unable to do anything with this land, and they're not paying rent or carrying insurance, as far as I know. And it was vetoed as well this 2 weeks ago. The fourth bill there is a tech veto message was that it wasn't a wide, there was no indication that this was a widespread problem. So the fourth bill is a, was in an.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Does the state have to accept a quit claim? I've got three lawyers down there.
That's certainly the position that the mineral lessees take. There is a significant question in that regard. They have not been paying rent. These few individuals who have mining operations have not been paying rent since then. That's why we felt that it was appropriate to make it clear in the legislation that until they left, reclaimed the premises and left the property, that they were still under lease. But there is an argument to be made that they are in holdover status, and that is an argument.
The statute expressly states that a lessee can quit claim at any time,
right.
And that language is reflected in their leases.
And so their legal position is that their responsibility ceases.
If there is contamination, the responsibility remains even though the ownership may have changed, correct?
Under certain laws, that's absolutely right. But the commission can also be, as a property owner, be held liable for activities that take place on its property. So there's problems associated with that.
The other thing that we'd like to look into is whether or not in new leases we can expressly contract to waive that provision of the law, that the lessee would be required to do that for new leases. So we're going to look into different remedies that we have under this.
I would urge that the commission staff continue to pursue this issue and enter into discussions with the governor's office to try to sort this thing out, because it's there seems to be a gray area here that could leave some liability for the state, and somebody could walk away from obligations that they had.
The commission has expressly rejected taking quitclaim deeds in other circumstances where there were toxics from the federal government, for example, at Honey Lake. But here, where there's an express provision that says they can quit claim at any time, that was our dilemma, I guess.
Are we writing leases that allow people to walk away with obligations unfulfilled?
There are laws under SMERA, and I can't remember this time what the acronym stands for, and the Department of Conservation has regulations that require reclamation and abandonment. The problem in these cases is that rent's not being paid while they continue to occupy the land, and then there's not liability insurance for in case of a personal injury, so the state could become liable.
I understand that. I'm just suggesting that we not write new leases that allow folks to walk away with unpaid or unfulfilled obligations.
Generally, our leases require that they return the premises to, you know, the original condition, but again, we're looking at putting in provisions that will more expressly address the problem we're talking about today. Absolutely.
Okay. John?
Do you know, what's the loss to the state for the payments that aren't being made? How many instances do we have over what period of time?
There are two current leases, one in Lake County and one in Southern California, and we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars if the lease were to continue during the reclamation process. On an annual basis, so nothing major, but this money is, most of these lessees are on school lands. This money would go to the Teachers Retirement Fund. CalSTRS has supported this bill. So we're looking at not a ton of money, but
I think the issue in terms of revenue generally is that we charge both rent and a royalty rate. So the rents are fairly low because of the property's off in the middle of nowhere and doesn't have that high an appraised value. But then we get a percentage of the royalty. So the actual income while the operation is underway is sometimes significant, but it drops once that production ceases.
And then how many of these properties, and I use this term very loosely, are protected under the statute from quit claiming or allowing them to quit claim, right? I'm worried about the exposure.
I think we'd have to go back and find out how many leases we have. It might be all of the existing leases, but this is a legal matter, and before I answer conclusively, I'd like to discuss this among staff and get back to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. I'll add that there's an omnibus bill that just passed in special session, which includes item number 4, which is a technical flaw in the code that prevents the commission from obtaining land patents from the Bureau of Land Management in certain circumstances. So the bill received unanimous support, and we feel like that it's a legal issue, and it should be signed. Then the bottom three rows are bills that I'm bringing to your attention because you guys will have heard these items in previous meetings, or you will hear about them in the future. The Candlestick Hunters Point bill was signed by the governor. It authorizes a land exchange that the commission, subject to the commission's approval, and in the next, I think the timeline is 2 or 3 years, you guys will probably be presented a land exchange proposal for the San Francisco Candlestick Hunter Point area.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, may I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
I don't understand, Mr. DiBernardo, what exactly did SB 792 do?
So the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency is the sponsor behind this bill, and they have a redevelopment project for the Candlestick Hunters Point area. There is sovereign land in that area that is all over the place and mixed or adjacent to private land. And as part of the redevelopment project, they've proposed an exchange to help implement their redevelopment project.
So this bill effectuated that exchange?
It authorizes the exchange. There's a proposed map. The commission has to ultimately...
The commission has to ultimately act on it, but it authorizes the exchange.
Correct. Correct.
It tees it up for this body to review it and approve it. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Correct.
And we've had legal staff, such as Jennifer Lucchese, who have worked very hard on this.
We've been extensively involved to make sure that when the project comes to you, it'd be one that we could recommend approval on. But ultimately, our belief is this we would oppose this legislation if it didn't leave final discretion to the Lands Commission on disposal of state tidelands.
Is the commission staff working with the redevelopment agency as they proceed to swap pieces of land around to gain, I suppose, a contiguous parcel for their development?
That's right. They're mutually beneficial goals here. The property there is extremely disjunct. In some places, the blocks have been sold off, but the public trust still applies to the streets in front of them. And so from a land use perspective, we don't have any real way to use that public trust land. And the same thing affects the developer, where they're trying to consolidate some blocks. There's some public trust lands right in the middle of where they're trying to put a building. So it benefits all of us to move all of our property as close to the shore as possible, contribute to a shoreline park or something like that, and eliminate the property that's inland. And then similarly, we gain the stuff that's closest to the property. So definitely this is being driven by the developer, but we also see it as an opportunity for us.
I would just really urge, Paul, that you and your staff engage early and as often as necessary so that our interests, the public's interests, are brought in early in the process rather than waiting until the end and then trying to sort it out at that point.
We've probably been working on this for 2 or 3, maybe even 4 years at this point, and there's some tough battles sometimes in terms of the negotiations about assuring that we get equal value preserved for the state and the public trust lands.
Thank you.
I just want to add that Department of Parks and Recreation is a big player in this project as well, and in addition to your own council's representation, the Attorney General's office is also involved. So,
well, we have had an example here in Sacramento where if you hang tough, you can win. Thank you.
The second to last item is the fee on plastic bags, which, if you recall, on June 1st, the commission passed a resolution supporting these two bills and the general concept of imposing fees on plastic bags to prevent plastic bag pollution. It's still in committee. It's a two-year bill. And then the last one, I know public comment in the past, especially in San Diego, has brought up the concern of the children's pool beach in La Jolla. A bill was passed and signed by the governor that allows the city of San Diego to make the ultimate decision as to what happens to that beach. So,
I'm sorry, may I ask, what did SB 428 finally do? It punted? Essentially punted to the city?
Right.
It said do whatever you solve it.
Right. The original statute in the 1930s had a specific use for that beach.
For children.
For children.
And then we came back and we said, well, it can be for children or for seals.
Well, we as a commission remain neutral on the bill. We
right.
felt that.
But the state's position now is that we've punted the issue. Is that right?
We left it up to the locals to decide.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood that one.
Would you like the responsibility?
No. So that's it for the 2009 legislative update. The next slide, please. There are three proposals that have been noticed for this meeting that I will ask. I'll ask for your sponsorship at the end of the presentation. The first legislative proposal has to do with the trespass issue that we deal with so frequently. It would give the commission the administrative authority to administratively impose penalties against persons who construct, maintain, own, use, possess unauthorized structures or facilities on state lands. The proposal is modeled after similar statutes that the state of New York, Texas, Washington, Oregon, and the California Department of Transportation have against people who encroach onto state lands. And I'm currently in talks with the Department of Parks and Rec and Fish and Game, because they are also interested in the idea. And so I ask for your sponsorship of this particular legislative proposal. The second legislative proposal has to do with audits. That was talked about quite a bit earlier. It would create a legislative mandate for the commission to conduct full audits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. DiBernardo, I have a suggestion on the legislation as you craft it. In line with the chairman's comments earlier, you may want to craft the bill where it explicitly says that the costs associated with the auditors shall not be paid out of the general fund, but somehow recovered. Through the audit proceeds or something. In other words, put some language in there that would put into law and make it clear what we'd like to try to achieve, because my sense is that if you introduce a bill asking for staff that otherwise it'd be general funded, you'll never get the bill out of the first house. Okay, so if you want to follow up with me, I'd be happy to work with you on that. But I think if you look for some sort of reimbursement funding mechanism, that you'd stand a better chance in actually getting that bill through the process.
I appreciate the suggestion. I could talk to you after the meeting. And then the third legislative proposal is deals with our land bank fund. We have monies donated into the land bank fund to provide for management and improvement of our trust lands. It's not expressly stated that the monies donated into this fund can be used to provide access to these public trust lands, which do improve these trust lands. And this would be, it could be considered a technical amendment to the land bank fund so that we could use the monies to provide things such as wheelchair access or driveways or trails to public trust lands. So I would ask, unless there is any particular proposal here that there isn't unanimous consent on, that I guess that group all three proposals into one motion for sponsorship. We have a land bank fund in which we receive donations for management improvement of trust lands, and it is not expressly provided in the statute for the trust fund or for the land bank trust fund that money could be used to provide access to trust lands. And so this would expressly.
The specific need arises, generally this money goes into the fund for a particular purpose. And the fund was originally established to allow for when there are land exchanges where the public is not getting full value for the land that's coming out of the trust in exchange for what's coming in, the person proposing the exchange can put in the deficit, and then we spend that money to buy replacement public trust lands. So that money going in is for that very express purpose, and we would not want this legislation to undercut that purpose. But we also occasionally get money in there, and the one that comes to mind are what's called the NRDAs, the Natural Resource Damage Assessments, that occur after oil spills. And different state agencies participate in that process. Fish and Game generally is responsible for taking a portion of the money and using it for biological impacts from an oil spill. Often our part of that process involves taking money for impacts of public access to public trust lands. And so the money that we get out of those oil spill funds is generally used for public access purposes, but there's no authorization in the fund right now that technically allows us to put that money in the fund and then spend it for public access. So it's generally to deal with that. The intent is, and in fact the reality will be, that the intent is not to take money that's been put in that fund for other purposes and divert it to public access. It's just to allow money that comes in for that purpose to be spent for that purpose.
In drafting the legislation, it seems to me that you want to keep the two sources of money separated.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And there needs to be some language that basically says, and this is poorly worded, but something to the effect of monies put into the CAPLAF fund for public access improvements may be spent for public access.
Okay. Further discussion on these? I don't know if we need a motion or just the acquiescence of the commission.
I think because we're asking the commission to sponsor these, that staff would be more comfortable.
Mr. Chairman, I would move approval of the staff recommendation on this item.
Second.
Without objection, it will be a unanimous vote.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Unanimous on the motion. Thank you. Okay. Paul, where are we going next?
Well, as we previously indicated, the next item, item 60, has been delayed until the December meeting. Item 61 is our final matter, and this involves the exercise of the public trust easement in an area on North Lake Tahoe. And Curtis Fossum, our chief counsel, will make the presentation.
Thanks, Kim.
Chairman Garamendi.
Before you start, Curtis, sure. We have a couple of comments from the public on this issue, and we'll take those following your presentation.
Very good. Chairman Garamendi, Commissioners Chung and Sheehy, item 61 requests the Commission to take certain action involving an approximate 2-acre area in the bed of Lake Tahoe lying between the ordinary high and low water marks just west of the boundary separating the state of Nevada and California on the North Shore. Proposed Commission action is to consider and determine the public's needs and uses of the land subject to the public trust and authorize the removal of a metal fence located within the shore zone and to compensate the property owner for its value if it's determined to be a lawful improvement. As outlined in the staff report, the Commission exercises its authority and responsibility and makes determinations involving public trust property of the state whenever it takes action involving those interests. Today already you've exercised those rights involving property interests of the state along the Pacific coast from San Diego Bay and Batiquitos Lagoon in the south to Humboldt Bay and the Eel River in the north. You've also taken action approving projects involving public property rights within four separate waterways in the Delta, and finally approved uses at Owens and Donner Lake and of course Lake Tahoe. In both San Diego Bay and San Francisco Bay, the property rights managed by the Commission involved only the mineral estate, not the fee title. In the present proposed action, the state's property rights involved also do not include the fee title interest, but are an easement held by the state as an incident of its sovereignty in trust for the public. When the Commission takes action involving the state's property rights, it's not acting as a governmental agency exercising regulatory authority, such as the California Coastal Commission. Rather, it acts as a property owner managing the public's property interests, like the Department of Parks and Recreation. On five prior occasions, beginning in 1975, the Commission's acted to protect the public's property rights by formally exercising the state's retained easement involving sovereign public trust lands in which the fee interest had been conveyed into private ownership. The details of those actions involving protection of the public trust needs and uses involving thousands of acres are in the staff report, and I will not repeat them here. Those exercises of the state's retained easement rights were in response to concerns raised by members of the public and organizations which sought to protect areas where the state has conveyed into private ownership portions of the bed of a navigable waterway. In each instance, it was determined that there were threats that would impact the public's trust needs and uses of those lands, and that formal action by the Commission was necessary to protect the public's interest in the property. As early as 534 AD, Roman Emperor Justinian, in setting forth the foundations of Western law, stated that by the law of nature, these things are in common to mankind: the air, running water, the sea, and consequently the shores of the sea. The common law of England long acknowledged the unique character of sovereign lands and the separation of the jus privatum, of the king's private property right he could convey to his lords, from the jus publicum, which was reserved for public use. Many state and federal courts in the United States have also described the significant limits on a state as trustee of the public's interest. No clearer statement can be made than that of the United States Supreme Court in 1892 regarding Lake Michigan. The state's title to its tideland is a title held in trust for the people of the state so that citizens may enjoy the navigation of the waters, carry on commerce over them, and have liberty of fishing free from obstruction or interference from private parties. Likewise, the California Supreme Court has made clear that when the state or its local trustee holding ownership of the easement takes an action in furtherance of public trust needs, the servient, privately owned fee interest must give way, and such action does not result in a taking of private property rights. In 1913, the Supreme Court in the California fish case involving San Pedro made that action. In 1936, in the Newcomb case involving Newport Bay, a similar action, and in 1971, Mark's decision involving Tomales Bay, followed by the 1980 decision in the Berkeley case involving San Francisco Bay. In each one of these instances, the private underlying fee interest had been conveyed by the state into private ownership, and the public's easement was exercised in a way, and the court made clear that that was within the authority of the state to do so. All of those are of the bifurcated nature of the title of shorelands and the limitations on the property interest, private property interest. In 1981, the California Supreme Court in State of California versus Superior Court of Lake County, Lyon, known as the Lyon case, held that the shore zone area between high and low water on inland tidal waterways had been state-owned upon admission to the Union in 1850. The federal law clearly is in accord, and patents of land from the United States do not convey title below the high water mark. However, the court ruled against the state's assertion of fee ownership to the high water mark and held that they would interpret the Civil Code Section 830 enacted in the 1870s to give the state's fee interest to adjacent owners of land. The court also held that the legislative enactment of the code section did not divest, extinguish, or abandon the public's interest in the shore zone, and that the same incidence of the trust applicable to tide lands also applied to non-tidal navigable waters, and that the public's interest is not confined to the water but extends to the bed of the water. It's a very important concept. Likewise, in the Supreme Court's earlier decisions involving tide lands conveyed into private ownership, the court made clear that a fundamental principle of California property law is that the state's trust obligations and public rights involving its waterways may not be blithely extinguished. These rights include but are not limited to navigation, commerce, fishing, and recreational uses. The Supreme Court decisions of Lyon and Fogarty, along with their precedents, all clearly enunciate the authority of the state when acting to protect the public's interest in public trust lands that have been conveyed into private ownership. Following the U.S. Supreme Court's denial of certiorari involving the Lyon and Fogarty decisions, the Commission on December 17, 1981, unanimously approved a calendar item, number 20, relating to the court's decision. A copy of that is on your screen as to what the Commission's action involved. It included directing staff to send this notice to all waterfront property owners with leases, applications for leases, or proposed project within the easement, informing them of the result of the court's decisions and how the Commission intended to implement those decisions. The court's decisions and the Commission's notice also made abundantly clear that the state has the obligation to compensate the owners of the underlying fee when the state exercises its authority over the easement to remove a lawful improvement. With that background on the last 1,500 years of jurisprudence, what's the action before the Commission? The subject property involves an area commonly referred to as Bucks Beach or Speedboat Beach, and is one of Lake Tahoe's most scenic locales, with sandy beaches and dramatic boulder outcroppings. The area is well known for its sandy bottom and is a popular swimming spot. The shore zone area includes approximately 2 acres and 1,100 lineal feet of land on the north side of Lake Tahoe, between Brockway and Kings Beach to the west, and the Nevada border on the east. The upland involves 7 parcels of land as depicted on Exhibit A and on this slide. Hopefully. Do we have the slide that shows the map? If not, it is...
There's a map. Back up a bit.
There we go. On this map, you can see the border of the state of Nevada on the right and the extent of the beach and the exercise that the commission is being asked to take on the left. There are several... Let me proceed on that. The upland involves 7 parcels of land as depicted, and Mr. and Mrs. McNeil own the 2 parcels immediately adjacent to the state line. Mr. Mark Day Sawtelles, as trustee of the Day Sawtelles 2000 Trust, owns the 2 lots west of and adjacent to the McNeils, as well as the next parcel to the west, which is held in the name of Hi Ho LLC. West of the Hi Ho property is a dedicated public street, Harbor Avenue, which is owned by Placer County, and west of Harbor Avenue is a parcel owned by 9898 Lake LLC. The beach involving this parcel, the last parcel mentioned, has been utilized by the public without incidents or conflicts with the public, with the upland owners being reported to our office. We are informed by the Placer County Assessor's Office that at this locale, none of the property owners is being assessed or paying taxes for land within the shore zone below that assessor's depiction of the approximate high water mark that was on the slide that we just saw. The North Lake Tahoe Public Utility District manages the street parcel for Placer County. This is the street, the end of the street. The North Tahoe Public Utility District has posted a sign on the entrance to the public accessway that cites Placer County ordinances prohibiting littering, dogs, and other pests, depending on your predilection, glass containers, alcoholic beverages, and fires on the beach, limiting the hours of public use to day use only between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. Harbor Avenue provides access also via a stairway to the lake. An investigation in the early 1970s by commission staff included information that a realtor who had been in the area since the 1940s stated the area had always been a public area, that the public had spread east and west of Harbor Avenue, that residents had chased members of the public off the beach at times, and had posted an armed guard. The investigation notes concluded that further consideration and study clarifying the public rights to the beach could prevent future conflicts, and that there appears to be no problems arising from the use of the beach by the public at the present time. This investigation was taking place before the commission took the position of high water on the lake. Here's a photo of a wooden fence that previously existed in the shore zone along Harbor Avenue in the 1980s. Staff has been informed by members of the Hills family, which previously owned all of the waterfront property beyond the fence to the border with Nevada, that they would periodically attempt to keep the people off the beach prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Fogarty. Staff was also informed that following the decision, the Hills family abided by the Supreme Court's decision and no longer excluded the public, and that when the Day Sawtelles acquired the lands adjacent to the fence in 1989, they were informed of the public's rights in the shore zone. In 1997 or 1998, the Day Sawtelles replaced the wooden fence with a metal one that you'll see on this slide. Staff is informed that no county permit was required for the new fence, and that a TRPA, which is Tahoe Regional Planning Authority, enforcement action was resolved by a TRPA staff member grandfathering the structure based on the existence of the prior wooden fence that had been in existence prior to TRPA's creation. Documentation of that is Exhibit J in your calendar item. Information from the Department of Fish and Game and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is that the new fence required a permit from those agencies when constructed, and that they are unable to locate any application, file, or permit for the fence. Although the middle fence was constructed after the Fogarty decisions in 1981 and 1986, the commission staff was not made aware of it until after it was constructed in 1997 or 98. As stated in the calendar item and included as Exhibits H and I, the staff in 98 and again this year requested the Day Sawtelles to remove the fence. On warm, sunny days on the beach westerly of the metal fence separating Harbor Avenue and the Hi-Ho LLC property, staff has observed many members of the public enjoying the lake and the beach easement area, while relatively few members of the public venture beyond the fence with its subject to the control of owner signs on the fence and the no trespassing signs that were placed on the beach area in front of Hi-Ho and the De Sautels property. For more than 10 years, the commission staff has, and let me point out that those private property signs there have been removed after our letter. The ones on the fence remain. For more than 10 years, the commission staff has received periodic reports and complaints from members of the public of their being prevented access to those portions of the bed of the lake easterly of the metal fence. Beginning this summer, the number of complaints increased. These complaints have included claims by significant numbers of public users of harassment and intimidation by property owners or their agents, resulting from the public's attempts to access the public easement area between the fence and the Nevada boundary. Specifically, the public has reported being confronted by individuals, including private security guards, who assert the beach is private and who in some instances have threatened them with arrest for trespass if they do not leave the beach. Some of these complaints are included in your packet, along with other emails and letters submitted, including those from the property owner's representatives, all of which will be made part of the public record. There have been complaints made of verbal harassment, use of aggressive dogs, photographing of individuals, including small children, at close proximity, and purported attempts to drive them off the beach. In past years, owners have made calls to the Placer County Sheriff's Office in an attempt to have the public removed from the beach or cited for trespass. The deputies have declined to do so when informed that the public has the right to be on the beach below the high water line. The elevation of 6228.75 was established by the Court of Appeal in Fogarty 2 in 1986. Commission staff has made several contacts with Placer County staff and met and discussed the situation there earlier this month. That the members included members, representatives of the County Council's Office, County Sheriff's Office, and their Property Management Division. The Sheriff's Office representative indicated there had been no crimes reported on the beach this year. He also indicated that in past years, cable TV wire had been strung on a pier there with warnings about electrocution. Apparently, in one incident, sand was kicked in the face of someone lying on the beach to intimidate them, resulting in litigation. And finally, these acts stopped after the Sheriff's Department prevailed on the homeowners to have these actions curtailed. The Sheriff's Office representative also indicated the belief that removal of this fence would reduce a lot of the issues. The portion of the metal fence within the public trust easement area extends waterward approximately 41.7 feet. Your surveyors were up there a few weeks ago to locate the elevation of 6228.75, which is the distant person holding the white pole there, and of course the end of the fence is there. That's how we were measuring it. During times of high water at the lake, the fence acts as a complete barrier to navigation by kayak, canoe, raft, and other shallow watercraft, and other forms of passage, swimming, wading, walking along the shore zone of the lake and the beach, and also interferes with fishing and other shore zone recreational activities. Just that prior slide was an important one because although the public obviously would have trouble walking around the fence right now, clearly this fence also at high water interferes with other rights of the public. As was previously stated, the commission in its prior formal trust exercises took action due to evidence indicating a threat to public trust needs and uses of lands held in private ownership that were subject to the easement retained by the state and under the commission's jurisdiction, as is this area. The commission and its staff have both taken prior action seeking to remove fences or other obstructions limiting public use on waterways throughout the state. Other fences at Lake Tahoe, placed below high water, have been removed from the shore zone at the request of the commission and also by action taken by the United States Army Corps of Engineers and by local government. As a result of investigating new complaints from the public this year, staff determined that in addition to problems associated with the interference of public use of the easement, the lessees of two of the commission's leases in the area were in breach of their leases. When we wrote those property owners notifying of the violations, we were contacted by them, and in one instance with the McNeils, they removed the barriers to public access that were put underneath the pier. We subsequently heard from members of the public that they did that for about a day and then they placed them back. When contacting the Hi-Ho and De Sautels, They had an application before us. They have amended their application, and on item number 50 today, you approved a new lease for two buoys that they conveyed to themselves, holding title as Hi Ho. So that has been resolved, and their council have informed us that those no trespassing signs that were on the beach have been removed from their property. It's important to note, I believe, at this point, that the lease with the McNeils that allows them to use the state's property for their pier also has a specific contractual obligation that they not impair the public trust area by storing or placing any items below elevation 6228.5. So in addition to the public's trust rights that exist on the property, they've also agreed to not place or store anything on the that would impair public access rights. I want to also point out that, and you'll see in the last slide, not now, but in the last slide that we will show you, that whereas the Des Sautels had placed their no trespassing signs very close to the water, the evidence is that the McNeils property has placed no trespassing signs, but they're very close to the high water mark, and therefore, although we can't verify their location yet, they may not be improper signs. On August 25th, staff letter to Des Sautels once again informed them of the public's trust easement and asked them to remove the metal fence. The letter referred to complaints from members of the public, informed them that the signs needed to be removed, and they complied with that. However, they have not complied. We received a letter from their attorneys saying that they would not remove the fence at that time. Subsequent to that, we did have a meeting, following the meeting with the Des Sautels, we did receive a letter from their council say they're willing to take the fence off there, subject to certain conditions. At the meeting with the Des Sautels on September 2nd, they referred to a number of events that they allege have occurred on the beach, stating they consider the matter to be one of health, safety, and protection of private property. They said that there had been drunken parties, the property had been used as a public toilet, acts of trespass, theft, vandalism, nudity, lewdness by members of the public. They also stated that the results in their numerous requests for action by the Placer County Sheriff's Office didn't resolve their concerns. This is one of the main reasons we met with the county after that and went over the calls that had been made on this beach for the last 3 years to see how much concern there was on these. As I mentioned earlier, the Sheriff's Office representative who had been there working in this area for 16 years said there had been no criminal activity complaints in the last year. When we met with the Placer County staff representatives, we went over some of the issues with them as to enforcement of time, place, and manner restrictions on the beach. And we encouraged them to enforce reasonable health and safety ordinance to protect not only the private property owner's rights, but the public's use of the beach as well. And one of the recommendations that the commission staff is putting before the commission is to direct the staff to, in fact, work with the county to make sure that those ordinances are properly adopted and enforced. We also had offered to the McNeils to meet with them early in September, first week of September. However, their council had scheduled a meeting with us that was to take place yesterday. It's been rescheduled to take place next week. Commission staff also contacted the TRPA staff regarding the posting of signs for public and private areas. TRPA staff indicated that they would not even be necessary to obtain a permit from them for the private property owners to place no trespassing signs above the high water mark. And the staff informed the property owners that we had no objection to them placing fences or other barriers to protect their property above 6228.75 on their private property where the easement does not exist. Specifically, a letter that we received on September 16th from Des Sautels' attorney informed staff that, quote, we've begun the process of opening dialogue with the most likely stakeholders and agencies with authority to see our concerns can be addressed. He informed us that the no trespassing signs had been removed, but made no commitment to either stop the confrontation with public beachgoers or to remove the fence. nearly a month later, from a new attorney representing the East Sawtelles, they did offer to remove the fence, quote, if reasonable protections for their private property are agreed upon. Approval of the proposed commission's action does not preclude this from happening, and in fact directs staff to work towards this goal with the county. Following the Lyon and Fogarty decisions by the Supreme Court in 1981 and 1986, certain lakefront property owners sought to have the United States Supreme Court take those cases. Supreme Court declined. Staff of the Commission and Attorney General believe the property law of California has been well settled, as well as that in many other states that follow the common law precedents of England regarding the retained property rights of the public held in trust by the sovereign states involving lands below high water. Commission staff believes the interference with the right of the public to access the public trust easement area in question has reached a critical point, and that it is appropriate to take all action necessary to enforce that right. Therefore, it requests the Commission make a finding that the fence is inconsistent with the public's needs and use of the trust easement below high water at the subject property, and authorize the Commission to take all steps necessary to remove the fence or cause it to be removed, and to compensate the owners of the fee interest in the property where the fence is located for the value of the fence, if it's determined to be a lawful improvement, as required by Public Resources Code Section 6312 and case law. One issue that has arisen is whether the fence is actually located on the Hi-Ho property or built on Placer County land. From this slide, you can see this is from the Placer County surveyors, who in a recent survey determined, at least initially, that the fence is constructed on their right-of-way and not on the adjacent property. Our surveyors, when they went up there to check on the elevations of high water at the stairway, also believe that the monuments indicated on the property boundary up there are on the opposite side of the fence from the county's property, and that this fence is in fact encroaching on county. However, that will need to be, before any compensation or that issue is resolved, there'll probably be further surveys taking place. It's the Commission staff's position that if the owner of the fee title lands on which the metal fence is located can document that they've obtained a core permit for the fence or that no permit is required, the Commission must tender just and fair compensation for the lawful improvement when it's removed. Staff therefore requests the Commission authorize funds not to exceed $10,000 without additional Commission approval be available for those costs of removal and tender to the rightful owner should it be determined the fence is a lawful improvement. Because this may be on county property and because there is no apparent core permit, at least none has been shown to us, it may be that the Commission won't have to spend any money on this. The proposed Commission findings and authorization also include a resolution to be recorded in the Placer County Recorder's Office documenting the Commission's actions. The proposed actions will identify the public's trust needs and appropriate uses and determine that the existing improvements constructed on the beach by the property owners have not been determined to be a significant interference with the trust needs and therefore may remain with the exception of the metal fence that blocks both navigation, access, and other recreational use of the lands and its bed below high water. Finally, the proposed action authorizes the Commission to take all steps necessary, Commission staff to take all steps necessary or appropriate to implement the Commission's action, including appearance on behalf of the Commission in any litigation respecting the action taken by the Commission. The unanimous decision of the Supreme Court in the 1971 Marks versus Whitney decision made it clear that state action is not necessary to determine what public trust rights exist within the property, a privately owned shore zone easement. Those rights already exist and include the right to fish, hunt, bathe, swim, to use for boating and general recreational purposes the navigable waters of the state and to use the bottom of the navigable waters for anchoring, standing, or other purposes. The court describes instead the authority of the trustee of these rights, here delegated to the Commission by Public Resources Code Section 6301, to modify or extinguish those rights. In that, it states that it's a political question within the wisdom and power of the legislature acting within the scope of its duties as trustee to determine whether public trust uses should be modified or extinguished and to take the necessary steps to free them from such burden. In the absence of state and federal action, the court may not bar members of the public from lawfully asserting or exercising public trust rights on these privately owned tidelands. Again, the Supreme Court in Fogarty stated, we emphasize, as we did in Lyon, that these plaintiffs may use the shore zone for any purposes which are not incompatible with the public trust. Landowners who previously constructed docks, piers, and other structures in the shore zone may continue to use these facilities unless the state determines, in accordance with applicable law, that the continued existence is inconsistent with the reasonable needs of the trust. In that event, both statute and case law require the plaintiffs be compensated for the improvements they have constructed in the shore zone. How is a determination to be made as to whether a particular use or purpose by the owners of the fee interest in the shore zone is compatible or incompatible with the reasonable needs of the trust unless the state's trustee of that interest makes such a finding? That's precisely why the Commission is being asked to have the perpetuity of the fence abated and the public's exercise of their existing rights protected from interference. It will now be clear that the use of the shore zone to the exclusion of the public is an incompatible use, that the existing improvements placed by the owners of the fee interest are not incompatible with the reasonable needs of the trust, except for the metal fence, and that the landowners may continue to use the shore zone for any purpose or use not incompatible with the public's trust rights. Nothing precludes subsequent action by the Commission at a future date regarding this determination. In the last couple days, we've received correspondence from several interested parties. It appears there's some confusion regarding the shorthand terminology used by the Commission since 1975 of, quote, formal exercise of the trust, unquote, and the fact that this is the first occasion involving non-title trust property in which it's acted. As pointed out in the staff report and my presentation, the Commission today has exercised its trust responsibility in scores of approval and has done so in tens of thousands of times previously, including thousands of times on inland non-tidal waterways. The terminology of, quote, formal exercise of the trust, unquote, specifically refers to the five, or after today, six times, that rather than in response to an applicant requesting use of state property, it is in response to public concerns of threats or interference with the public's rights and interest in certain limited and defined areas. In each instance, the underlying fee interest had been conveyed into private ownership in the 19th century, but remained subject to the public's trust easement. The Commission held a public hearing and acted to protect the public's property rights by identifying the public's needs and appropriate uses of the easement, and by formally exercising the state's authority to protect the easement. Unlike the five prior acts of the Commission exercising that right in the subject action, the Commission is not determining that no further improvements by the property owner are allowed, but rather that the public's needs are in the existing improvements except for the fence, do not interfere with the public's needs of access and recreation, and nothing in this action prevents the property owners from using the shore zone for any purpose not incompatible with the identified public trust uses. The Commission is not acting as a regulatory agency in exercising the public's property rights. It's acting in its capacity as a property owner and manager of those rights. As pointed out in the several referenced Supreme Court cases, the public's rights of use already exist. It is the Commission's determining what, if any, action by the owners of the underlying fee interfere with those rights and which do not. That is the action the Commission is being asked to take. Some concerns have also been expressed that the Commission's action will recreate a cloud on title. The Supreme Court has made clear the state's property interest, or what some refer to as a cloud on title, has existed on the property since September 9, 1850, when we became a state. All the Commission's action does today is express the trustee of the state's easement's determination of what does and does not interfere with the existing easement and the rights of the public. Staff of the Commission respectfully submits calendar item 61 with a recommendation for Commission approval.
Mr. Folsom, thank you very much for a very extensive review of history going back 1,500 years and the more recent circumstances there at Lake Tahoe. I would like now to Tom.
Can I ask a couple quick questions of Mr. Folsom?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Folsom. Does the public trust doctrine make any distinction between saltwater and freshwater?
No. The Lyon case made it very clear that the same principles that apply to the tidelands that were in the prior litigation, the cases going back to 1913, I believe, in the Cal Fish case, all the way up to 1971 in Tamales Bay, in the Marks case, and in 1980 in Berkeley. In each of those instances, the state had actually sold property into private ownership and received compensation for that. In the Lyon and Fogarty case, the Supreme Court actually ruled that the legislature had given a title in 1872 to the low water mark. The federal government, when they conveyed away property, only conveyed it to the high water mark. The state owned the rest. But because of this action taken by the legislature in the 1870s and finally resolved by the Lyon court, the state was arguing that the state still owned a high water. But the court ruled, no, you've treated this as a low water boundary for such a long time. We're going to confirm that the fee title to the property was conveyed by that statute, but the legislature had never taken any action to divest the state of its public rights in the water. And so that they basically said those same interests that apply on those case, the case in the tidelands, such as the Marks case, applied equally to the property on non-tidal waterways. So below, between high and low water, the rights are the same.
Okay. How is the high and low water mark determined, and is there legitimate differences in opinion over how it's determined?
There certainly was. Just as in the Fogarty case, the state of California took a position it was high water. We also took the position in those cases that the high water mark was 6229.1, which is the high water for purposes of both TERPA's jurisdiction as well as the Corps of Engineers. They believe that's the high water. However, in litigating the boundary in the Court of Appeal in 1986, the court actually made it a lower elevation based upon a prescriptive theory, and that is the dam at Lake Tahoe, which has been there well over 100 years, had created a new condition to the lake, and that because California law provides for a prescriptive right to attach, an easement, in fact, to attach to property by use for a period of 5 years, they took a look at all the elevations the lake had been at since the dam was put on.
I'm sorry, this dam is holds the lake back from the Truckee River, is that it? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And what they looked at was any five-year period of prescription, and they took the lowest elevation that the lake had been during that continuous 5 years of high waters. And so that's where they got the 6228.75. So we lost a little bit there, but that was the ruling the Court of Appeal made, and that was also appealed by the some of the property owners of the lake, as was Fogarty 1. This is referred to as Fogarty 2, and in neither instance did the Supreme Court of the United States take cert on that. There are some arguments that have been put forward based on some of the briefs submitted on behalf of the commission by the Attorney General's office saying that it wasn't ripe. It's the same arguments they're making that this didn't exist until the court made the rulings. But the court's rulings was, in fact, that this right had existed since 1850 on the property.
And my last question, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fossum, how do we know what the high and low water marks were on September 9th, 1850?
And that's the point the court made, that it's really not important to know exactly where they were at that point in time. The law applying to water bodies is that those elevations can change from time to time by natural occurrences, certainly, and in some instances by artificial occurrences. So what we've got in California is, it's very common that people refer to where was the last natural location of this, because in some instances people fill, they'll put out a groin, they'll do something to change that water body, and it can be that the natural position prior to that will in fact have some impact on where the boundary is. But in other instances, artificial changes will not change the boundary or will change the boundary. So, for example, there's a specific code section that deals with accretions that says that the accretions have to be from a natural condition for them to go to the upland owner. Artificial accretions stay part of the state's ownership. And the court, again, in 1986, the Court of Appeal found that based upon some other prior cases in California dealing with artificial waterways that the public's rights attached to that area. They did not say that the state owned that in 1850, that element between high and, or excuse me, above the natural high to the artificial high. They said that the public, by its use of the property between high and low for that five-year period, and by the property owner's acquiescence to that, could not now claim that the easement hadn't attached to it.
Let's hear from the public on this issue. We have, let's see, I think three people that would like to testify. Mark Gunderson, attorney representing the Hilo LLC. Janice Hills, a homeowner. And Ashley Hills, a homeowner. And then there's Cheryl Sugel, representing herself. Mr. Gunderson.
Good morning. I'm Mark Gunderson, representing the Day Sawtelles, the Day Sawtelles Trust, and Hi-Ho LLC. As I have indicated to Mr. Fossum in my most recent correspondence, this is really a question of not listening to anecdotal evidence, which you've heard a lot of this morning, but rather the balance between the public's rights and that's rights of the private property owners that exist in this location. As you can see from the indications of the record, this beach is very heavily used, and the use is focused on traversing the property by Harbor Avenue down to the beach, and it's heavily used by members of the public. It is not only heavily used by members of the public, but it is heavily abused by members of the public. Placer County has not regulated the use of this beach. They have not regulated time, use, and manner of this beach, even though there may be regulations that exist. Placer County is unclear of the extent or the manner of its jurisdiction and has not exercised its jurisdiction to take care of the public nuisance that is created on this beach. This fence that you have seen did not come into existence 10 years ago. This fence did not come into existence 20 years ago. It came into existence in the 30s. And this fence has existed for a substantial period of time, and it has existed so that the Day Sawtelles and its predecessors in interest could demarcate their property from other property that exists that belonged to the county. That's why it's there. We understand that does create some degree of an impediment, but it has not created an impediment until very recently when the state has decided to exercise its jurisdiction. The concern that the Day Sawtelles have and the Day Sawtelle family have is that without regulation, this beach is abused and the public trust is not benefited by that adverse use, which flows now upstream or uphill from the high water mark onto the Day Sawtelles property. They have people trespassing on their property on a regular basis. They have people misusing their property on a regular basis, and there is no management or use by the Placer County officials to maintain this easement in a manner which is compatible with adjacent and private property uses. That is why there should be a negotiated resolution with all of the stakeholders that are involved, including state lands, Placer County, and the landowners. But it's precipitous to act and take this action today until that process has been taken to its logical conclusion. And we would suggest that this matter be tabled until those discussions have been had and the appropriate resolution reached among the parties.
If I might ask you a question, do you disagree with the position of staff that the fence creates a barrier to public access to the area that is under the easement, that is the distance between the high water mark and the lake itself? Is the fence a barrier?
It is an impediment, but it is not a barrier. People have certainly gone around it, they've gone over it, they've certainly found numerous ways to not use this, well, in fact, as a barrier.
Therefore, what purpose does the fence serve?
I'm sorry?
Therefore, what purpose does the fence serve?
The only thing that the Desautels have done is tried to indicate where their property line is versus the adjacent commercial or public property next
then
door.
Then you do not argue the right of the public to access on that area between the high water mark and the lake itself.
I think that's well settled law. I wouldn't be so precipitous to
then
argue.
And your argument
that
is principally one about the rights of the property owner above the high water mark to safety and trespass.
Well, or as to the low water mark, because the property that underlies the public trust property is owned by the private property interest.
But you're not arguing that the public has a right to recreate on it, to pass along and to recreate on that land.
We're not. But what we are saying is that there ought to be a balance between that use and the use of the underlying owner of the property.
Okay. And that is a law enforcement issue having to do with the conduct of the public.
Well, that's a policing issue. It's a police enforcement action because the state doesn't exercise its rights to police the public trust property. Someone must. The county has not and will not because it has stated to me on a number of occasions it doesn't know where its jurisdiction starts or ends and has been reluctant to apply these regulations on the public trust property.
Well, this commission can therefore resolve that issue by the proposed action.
I'm not so sure that they can because that Placer County Sheriff's Department is a different governmental agency.
Well, at least I think your argument was that the Placer County Sheriff's Department sees an ambiguity. It would seem to me that by our action, forcing the removal of the fence and asserting the rights of the public to pass and to use, that creates clarity.
I don't believe.
And then the sheriff could respond to that by at least no longer arguing ambiguity.
I don't think that's the issue. The issue is not the fence. It's whether or not Placer County wishes to exercise jurisdiction on the public trust property, which it has been reluctant to do.
Mr. Folsom is...
We took it very seriously about the concerns of the private property owners there as well. And so that's why, as I indicated in the staff report, that we met with Placer County and discussed with them the situation and indicated that, and they did indicate that they had confusion in the past because they didn't know in the past because they did not know where the high water mark was. We indicated to the property owners in the meetings we had so far and in correspondence that we would be willing to use the State Lands Commission staff to go out and actually locate that high water mark so that there would be clarity on that and that they could then put their signs legally keeping the public off their private property where no easement existed. The county was very positive about that because they would like to be able to enforce the laws out there and know what is private and what is public. So they supported that. They supported taking the fence down. They supported having a survey that would indicate where the high water mark was. And the commission, if it approves this action, is directing the staff to work with the county to adopt appropriate protections for that area. So I think that will help resolve all of these issues. And I even heard from a former property owner in the area who said, by removing this fence, it will take the pressure off the property owner to the west, who has a substantial number of people, excuse me, using the beach in front of their property, and if you remember the map, there's a significant area of beach that very few of the members of the public dare go on because of the harassment. So it will actually spread out the use that's there. Because there's limited parking in this area, the most use by this area is by neighbors, frankly, people in the neighborhood who just want to go down to the beach and enjoy that. It is close to Calneva. People can walk down there, I've been told, a 5-minute walk or so. And so it would be open to all the public, but there's very little parking. And so the fact is that it's quite unlikely that hordes of people would be going down there. The other thing I wanted to point out is that El Dorado County, not at Lake Tahoe, but on a river in California, sought to, because of the complaints of property owners about trespass, very similar to these, of of nudity and using a toilet on their private property, all kinds of issues, leaving trash behind, sexual activity, sought to shut down part of the American River within their jurisdiction to rafting. This commission, along with the Department of Boating and Waterways and the Attorney General's Office, took the county to court and says, you can arrest people for violating the law, you cannot prevent the public from using this area. And so we think that it would be precipitous to not have appropriate regulations in the area. We're going to work with the county and encourage them to look at the issues. They've already posted the signs at the top of the access way there, and we'll certainly work with them. They've placed trash cans in the area so the public can put trash in the area, properly dispose of that, and we certainly don't want the public to go down there and violate the law there any more than we would have them violate it anywhere else.
Having said all of that, the responsibility of this commission is to assure the rights of the public. With regard to law enforcement, while we are certainly encouraging the appropriate enforcement of any existing law, that responsibility resides with others. And therefore, our particular responsibility here is to make sure that the rights of the public to traverse and to use are maintained. It appears as though the staff has offered to provide, at no charge to the property owners, a valuable service of surveying and locating the precise location of the high water mark, at which point the property owners can do what they want to do from that point on, or that point upward. Now, we have two more witnesses, if we might.
Thank you for
your time. Thank you. We have the Hills, Janice Hills and Ashley Hills.
I'm Janice Hills. My family has owned that property in the past, well, since the 30s. It was sold at one time to Blixa, the McNeil property, and he sold it to Carol McNeil's and Bob McNeil. The Desitel property was sold directly from my father-in-law back in 1989, I believe you said today. I have lived at 150 Harbor in Brockway for close to 40 years. I lived there 365 days. My children were raised going to the beach there. We have a tremendous interest in using that beach for our neighborhood and families. And we have found it in the last 10 or 11 years increasingly more difficult to access that beach. We have been met with armed guards, police harassment, people harassing you, photographing you, not just a video camera on a pier, but people actually following you around the beach for hours, just so that you have the worst time possible and you will not come back. My daughter, Ashley Hills, who is here today, is 27, received a scholarship from Sierra Nevada College. I wrote a letter of thank you to the board members there for giving her the scholarship. Unbeknownst to me, Bob and Carol McNeil were on the board. I received a letter of threat, which I have at home and I haven't given to anybody here, but I will make it available, that my daughter's behavior on their beach is going to cost her college career. My daughter went in to see the president of Sierra Nevada College, Ben Solomon, and had a four-hour meeting and discussion to save her scholarship because of my daughter accessing the property that we've always used for beach. She was met with caretakers screaming and yelling at her, kicking sand in people's faces. That's not unusual. It's getting worse. This year she came up to me after being on the beach in August crying, telling me that they were going to arrest her for, I said, for what? She said, for trespassing on the beach. Well, I mean, it's just one thing after another. A few years ago, the Pays and the Desitels hired two African-American football players to collect $4 apiece from people coming down to the beach at the entrance. My ex-husband was mortified because people were starting to cut through the property to get down to the beach. We asked them what they were doing, and they said, well, why should we pay $4 to come here? And it was told to them by Mark Desitel that you litter, and that's what I'm going to charge you. Well, that didn't fly because there were going to be fights, and my ex-husband told them that those two guys, they should really leave, that they have no business there. So that's just one thing, and it's another thing, and another thing. And I am in favor of removing the fence. Mark Desitel has placed a sign, and it has not been removed by TRPA, although they've asked him many times to do it, that the right to pass is permission of subject of owner. Will people staying at the Cal Neva for a day or two get turned away constantly because they read that sign and they're law-abiding citizens and they leave, but they're misled. And I go down there and I tell people, oh no, you have the right to sit there, and they look at me and they say, well, I don't want to get arrested. Well, I started making an appearance every single day in August to check out this. They put up three signs that were metal. You've seen them there, the orange ones with a rebar in a 5-gallon drum cemented. Three of these signs. One of them met you right at the end of this fence, and I want to tell you about this metal fence. They brought it out to a rock outcropping that is almost impossible if you're carrying a child or a towel or an umbrella or a raft or anything to maneuver through. There are, and I believe they placed these rocks there on purpose. There's some foot traffic that you can make through, but I think those rocks are there now. And there was a sign there, and a young man who was about 20 who refused to give me his name, just screaming and yelling at people from a sitting position way up to where I would say the high water mark is, which is on their land property, not the beach. Hey, you, get out of here. Hey, you, get out of here. Well, I called my ex-husband. My daughter came back because we are going to support our family members. And I told him to go down there and find out what was happening. He went down there, explained who he was, Reuben Hills the Fourth, and the guy just berated him all over the place, told him if he didn't leave, he was calling the police. My ex-husband said, well, I will wait to talk to the police because we know most of the police in the area. We've lived there long enough. Well, they never came. He sat there for an hour and a half. And the next day I went down there and I sat down and I was told that I had to leave as well. I find that this fence is a psychological and a physical barrier to all the people that enjoy that beach that should. And I believe that in today's technology with video cameras and all the people that Mark Desitel and the McNeils hire, there's no threat of any property damage. I'd like to ask the McNeils and the Desitels for any insurance claims that they've had from damage that has been done to them. And I assure you, they can't produce any. There are no pictures. There's no reason to believe that there is nudity or naked things going on. It just, there's too much security guard. There's three people that work for Mark Desitel watching you at all times. There's a security guard that I believe is a Placer County off-duty sheriff that walks that pier like he's walking the gangplank in San Quentin, telling people you're being televised. You're being televised. We're watching you. Nobody wants to go and have interaction with these people. They just want to go down to the beach and go swimming. That has become impossible. My daughter comes home in tears, shaking every time she goes there. This girl is 27 years old. We've never done anything to anybody down there. And I would say with all the security, show me one example. Show me some police reports. Show me something. It's all a bunch of baloney just to keep this a private, exclusive lakefront property that they want. And the people are all turned away to sit on Mark Pay's property, and he's here today. He didn't have a card to speak, but I bet if you asked him, he has really no complaints except for the fact that he has the overload of people there. There's no property damage to him. He has a caretaker that lives off-site, as Mark Desitel has one that lives on-site, and so did the McNeils. So I think they villainize and demonize the public without any proof at all, and that I think it's getting to a ridiculous level of confrontation with the public. And as a homeowner there, I'm afraid to go down there. It's not a pleasant experience. It's a beautiful piece of property. It's nice for people to go swimming, and it's very popular. But I will say that they have no security issues in 2009 with all of the, you know, you could put a video camera up and you can be anywhere in the world and be watching your property. So There's nothing to substantiate any of these claims except for the fact they want it exclusively to themselves. And I will tell you, I will not stand for anyone harassing or berating my children at whatever age. I just won't allow it. And I just ask you and tell you how grateful I am for the investigation that you've done and for the commissions to go ahead and remove this fence and also the debris from the previous fence. And it's in the pictures that you had on today. You really can't see it, but there's cement pilings with sheared off timbers that if you fell on it, you would be killed. And they're just sitting right around loosely and have been. And I could say in the 40 years that I've lived there, I think there's one person that I saw being taken out of there and he had jumped off the rocks in the water by himself. So there's no safety issue. There's just no evidence. So I just want to tell you that my ex-husband couldn't be here today because he works, but he's in support of removing of that fence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ashley?
Hi. My name is Ashley Hills. I'm 27 years old. I've lived in the Speedboat Beach neighborhood my entire life. I'm in support of the commission's decision for removal of the fence at Speedboat Beach. I agree with the staff and also with Placer County Sheriff that the removal of the fence would greatly solve the problems that arise at Speedboat Beach. The fence is a substantial physical as well as psychological barrier to the public's rights to access and enjoy the public trust, which is already theirs. The fence also enables lakefront homeowners to continually harass and intimidate the public on a minute-by-minute basis. I myself have suffered severe emotional distress as a result of this intimidation and harassment. My scholarship and education opportunities have been threatened during my undergraduate work by these homeowners, merely for exercising my rights to use and enjoy the public trust easement. These homeowners and this fence make what should and can be an enjoyable experience a horrific one. I thank you again for considering the welfare of the public's right to use what is ours by removing the fence at Speedboat Beach, and thank you for such a thorough investigation of this matter.
I believe that completes the testimony from the public. I'm sorry, please. My apologies, I slipped that to the bottom. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Sherry Sugal, and I'm a resident of the neighborhood where Speedboat Beach is located, and I've frequented that beach for many years. Thank you for allowing me to comment on this very important issue. I agree with the commission's recommendation and the recommendation of the Placer County Sheriff that the fence should be removed. The fence is both a physical and a psychological barrier to the public's free exercise of its right to access the public trust at Speedboat Beach. While the Desautels and the McNeils have always hired guards to harass and intimidate the public from using the public beach, it has never been so bad as it was last summer. And I wanted to comment on this in relation to how it relates to the fence. Last summer, I was harassed every time I went to the beach, beginning on July 3rd, and was threatened with citations on more than one occasion simply for sitting on the beach, sometimes even while just walking in the water. On July 3rd, I witnessed Mrs. Desautels yelling at a group of people recreating on the beach. I quote, "This is my beach," quote, "Get off my beach," pointing to the signs on the fence, reading, quote, "Right to pass by permission and subject to control of owner." All of these actions that on behalf of the homeowners have caused me, my friends, my neighbors, emotional distress, and many of the threats that I have encountered were made in front of work colleagues, friends, and neighbors. On August 16th, I walked up to my neighbor on the beach who was engaged in a long discussion with Deputy Allen from the Placer County Sheriff's Department. The deputy was threatening to issue him a citation if he did not leave the beach. The deputy explained to us that he was following orders to issue a citizen's arrest on behalf of the property owner, again pointing to the fence as the division between the public and private property lines. When I offered my help to the deputy in showing him where the high water mark was, he responded to me that he was just following orders from his superior at the time to issue these citations. Myself and my neighbor agreed to leave the beach that day. I've also obtained a copy of a cease and desist letter that was issued by the attorney of Mr. and Mrs. McNeils to one of the local kayak rental companies in Kings Beach, claiming that his clients, quote, own down to elevation 6223, that his clients, quote, acknowledge the rights of the public to recreate in the waters of Lake Tahoe, and, quote, acknowledge the public trust doctrine is applicable to the land submerged under the waters of Lake Tahoe. The letter further demands that the kayak shop owner cease and desist aiding and abetting trespassers and direct his clients to public beaches that are maintained and have public toilet facilities. This kind of intimidation threatens not only the public, but also our local economy in Lake Tahoe at a time when many local businesses are struggling to survive. It is my understanding that an exhaustive review of past complaints filed with the Placer County Sheriff over the last 5 years have revealed that there have been no complaints of public drunkenness, lewdness, nudity, etc. at Speedboat Beach, contrary to the Desautels and the McNeils' repeated assertions, not one. And as you can see in the pictures, this is a very beautiful beach that the people of Lake Tahoe really love and enjoy and take care of and have acted as stewards of this beach for many, many generations. And I can even tell you that one of my friends who was cleaning up the beach was harassed by the Desautels guards and told that they needed to leave the beach. Finally, I just want to summarize by saying while I agree that the fence should be removed, I also believe that there needs to be continued monitoring and enforcement of the public's access to Speedboat Beach. I think that the homeowners have shown that they will use various forms of harassment and intimidation to limit access to the beach, including hiring security guards, video cameras, bullhorns to scare people off the beach. And I believe that the letters from the State Lands Commission and the removal of the intimidating, you know, no trespass signs corresponded with the end of the summer. So while it appeared that the landowners were complying with what was in the State Lands Commission's request, that actually the homeowners were just simply no longer interested in limiting access to the beach because people are only using the beach in the summertime, and that it is imperative, you know, that there also be signs showing where the approximate high water line is so that the public is really informed of what their rights are and which parts of the beach that they're able to use. I feel that the fence should be removed immediately this winter while the lake is at almost its record low water level so that the removal can be completed with minimal disturbance of the lake bed and the environment. And I would add to the record that the property owners should not be compensated for their outrageous attempt to steal public property for private gain. In fact, they should probably be fined. And thank you for allowing me to comment on this very critically important matter.
Thank you very much. I believe that completes the public testimony. We have before us the proposed action by the proposed by the staff. But before we get to that, there are two things that I would like to add to this discussion. First of all, I would ask that the commission staff, working with the Attorney General, deliver to the property owners, the upland property owners, a letter clearly stating the right of the public to pass and to recreate on the beach below the high water mark. And secondly, I would ask that the staff working with the Attorney General seek a restraining order against the property owners, the upland property owners, prohibiting them from any harassment of the public who are lawfully exercising the public's right to access and recreate on the land below the high water mark. I would ask that that be part of our proposed, of the action taken here today. The action of the property owners, of the upland property owners, is reprehensible. It is clearly contrary to the rights of the public, and it is the, as I see it, the responsibility of the State Lands Commission to make certain that the rights of the public to use the public land or easements that are on private land, to use that to the fullest extent allowed by either the law or the trust doctrine. Mr. Folsom, Mr. Thayer, would you comment on my two proposals?
We're certainly prepared to work with the Attorney Generals and communicate with the property owners there. We will also look into the appropriateness of issuing a restraining order at this time. I think we want to talk to the attorneys representing the property owners there, whether their clients will intend to abide by the action of the Commission and the law, existing law and rights there. And I think that the suggestion of obtaining a restraining order is certainly something that we were looking at should the property owners take action following the Commission's action,
but
is inconsistent with that.
I'm taking from the Chair's approach something different maybe than Mr. Fossum, which is that it's something that should be addressed now and that we'll work with the AG's office to do that.
Well, let me make it clear, it's the view of this chairman of this commission that there's considerable evidence presented at this hearing and in other documentation that the rights of the public are being abridged and that harassment is taking place. And therefore, I think it is appropriate to seek a restraining order based upon past action during this past summer so that next summer it does not occur, and should it occur, appropriate action by the court in contempt of that restraining order could take place. I want to lay the law down here. I want to be very, very clear about protecting the rights of the public. And if they don't get it, then they can take it up with the judge who issues the restraining order. I think there's plenty of evidence on the record that such an order is appropriate. And I want that fence out of there now. Okay, we have a proposed action as modified by my two suggestions. That's fine. John?
Can you give me a historical backdrop as to any good faith action taken by the property owners to work this out with the public? Right, as the Lieutenant Governor just has alluded, I find the evidence overwhelming that the landowners have taken action to deny access, in fact, the commentary offered today, to intimidate individuals, which I find, as John pointed out, reprehensible, I would add offensive, to people who have a legal and legitimate right to use those properties. And so just not to be entirely swayed by this, right, I'm trying to find fairness and balance in the record, and I haven't seen it. So if you are aware of circumstances where the landowner has tried to work this out properly, I'd like to hear it.
Well, let me just say that in trying to be fair to the property owners as well, I did point out that the signs on the McNeil property appear to be much higher than the ones that the De Sautels put, the no trespassing signs. They appear to be that if there has been actions taken by them below those signs, chasing people off the beach, which it certainly sounds like based on the testimony, that's different. But the signs themselves appear to be close, and we would certainly be willing to work with them to make sure that they are aware of the exact location of that high water mark. They have, on a couple of occasions, removed some of the things that were blocking public access underneath the pier, the McNeils did. We have had testimony again today that they probably did that because the season was over. We've had to tell them more than once in that regard. There has been extensive comments made about activities by both of the property owners or their employees about this harassment. There's no doubt about that based upon the correspondence we've received. We have had some witnesses by staff seeing the guards go down on the beach and basically people leaving after talking to them and so forth. I think what we staff is prepared to follow the commission's direction. We certainly want to communicate with the council for the property owners there to see if we can't do things, make agreements with them that that they will abide by the commission's actions here. But we are prepared to follow any direction that the commission gives us.
Yeah, I'm particularly disturbed to see that there's harassment without an offense, without certainly provocation. That's, you know, that additional step. But to assert right to that land to the exclusion of others is undeniably the worst offense to the use of these lands.
Let me add a couple of points to this. My suggestion and modification of the action proposed by staff is to seek a restraining order. That requires a court hearing, and we'll certainly give the opportunity to the Hills and anybody else that feels offended to appear before the court to state their case and their experiences, and for the property owners to counter if they choose to do so. But I think it is essential that we lay down the law, and we make it clear that in the coming season, in 2010, what is expected, what is lawful, and what actions cannot take place. I think there's a long history here of the upland property owners trying to force the public off the beach, and apparently with some success, including offense and including the actions that were stated in testimony given today. So I want to move forward. I'm very serious about this. I want to move forward. I want to see this before a court, proper jurisdiction, and let the court decide whether it's appropriate to have a restraining order. And then if there's some other modification, an agreement short of a restraining order, then let the court decide that. But we have to be very, very clear here. This isn't just about Tahoe. This is about the entire state of California. We have 1,000 miles of coastline, and there have been numerous attempts over the years for private upland property owners to prevent the passage of the public on along that coast. We have thousands of miles of rivers, and we need to be very, very clear about the public trust. This is a beautiful document that was produced by the State Lands Commission. It's worth nothing unless we're willing to make it clear that this is, in fact, the right of the public, and it'll be enforced against those who attempt to abridge it. So that's where I'm coming from on this, and I'd like to see, first, a letter delivered as quick as possible to the property owners stating the position of the public and the rights of the public, and followed up very quickly thereafter by a restraining order against the property owners for actions that would prevent the public from full enjoyment of their rights. So,
I'm sorry,
John, if you'd like to take the chair here, I'll make that motion.
Oh, yes, in one moment, Mr. Chairman, I want to just make one comment. I'd like to echo some of the comments of my fellow commissioners today. I'm shocked and very disturbed over the testimony that I've heard today about the harassment going on at this beach and the tactics being used. Assuming it's true, and I have no reason to believe that it's not, assuming it's true, I find that those actions just completely unacceptable and reprehensible. So I'm very sympathetic to that, and I think that the public's use of the sovereign lands needs to be clearly delineated and protected. That said, there is significant correspondence that I received just today, dated October 21st, from several different attorneys representing both parties. I have not had the chance to fully digest everything in there. And so while I am generally supportive of the staff recommendation and the comments of my colleagues on this body, I would be more comfortable voting on this at our next meeting after I've had a chance to digest it more, I realize that is not going to satisfy the chair, and so I have no objection at all, Mr. Chairman, to you proceeding, but I will abstain today.
Well, then let me pass the gavel to you, and if you'll
Mr. Chairman, did you have a motion you'd like to make?
I do. I want to move the staff report and amend it with 2 points. One is for the staff, together with the Attorney General, to deliver to the upland property owners a letter clearly stating the rights of the public, and secondly, to work with the Attorney General to seek a restraining order against any harassment or any action that would prevent the public to fully enjoying its rights.
Is there a second to that motion?
I second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those abstaining, let the record show Mr. Sheehy's abstaining. None opposed, that motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The gavel's back in your hand.
Thank you very much, Tom. Mr. Thayer, what other business is before the commission?
That concludes all of the agenda, and we have no closed session items.
Okay, we're going to move to a closed session. No closed session. Then the work of the commission is done. I want to thank the staff for the extraordinary work that they've done now and in the past. It's been a pleasure working with you thus far. Thank you so very, very much.
And let me say the same is true for working with the Lieutenant Governor, and we don't want to do any jinxing, so we won't say anything further, but nonetheless, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. We're adjourned.